Hello, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. We release a new episode every Sunday morning. Today, my guest is Ileana Douglas, author of the gorgeous new book, Connecticut in the Movies, From Dream Houses to Dark Suburbia. This book spans about 100 years from the silent film era up through the early 21st century. Ileana Douglas has starred in too many films for me to mention. You know her from the movies including Cape Fear, Ghost of My Heart, Goodfellas, and To Die For, plus the many television shows she's appeared on like Entourage, Seinfeld, and 6 Feet Under. Her first book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, and Other Stories from a Life Lived in and Out of the Movies, was named Best Pop Culture Book of the Year in 2015 by Entertainment Weekly. With Connecticut in the Movies, readers revisit classic films and are introduced to deep cuts. Ileana also places many contemporary films in context. My favorite chapter is Dark Suburbia Redux, which focuses on films like The Ice Storm from 1997, directed by Ang Lee and starring Kevin Klein and Sigourney Weaver. I love this book, but so do so many others. Here's what Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Ronan Farrow had to say. In Connecticut in the Movies, Ileana Douglas puts on her historian's hat and takes readers on a compelling tour of her adopted state's surprising, colorful, and sometimes dark history in cinema. Her adoration of the state and the movies leaps off of these pages, and it is infectious. Okay, let's dive in. Hey there, Ileana.
Hello. Nice to meet you virtually.
Nice to see you temporarily until the until the little glitch there. But I did scan the room and I make some mental notes about. I guess that's your new dream house or money pit in Connecticut where you are.
Yes, it is. Well, this room is done. I did my office first. I actually worked here in the office throughout the whole renovation, which is about 75% complete.
75% complete is scary, yeah. Though, right? Because it's all the finish work. Is that what you're left with at this point?
All the hardest parts, like which I talk about in the introduction, is the kitchen was so bad. There literally were no joists under the floor. Everything was sitting in dirt.
Oh, my God.
The basement was flooded. My plumber, in his great New England salt of the earth humor, said, when a pipe burst, said, well, it's not everyone who can brag they have a pool in their basement.
I just, you know, when I read that it was from 1810.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, boy. Because my house is like, I live in Massachusetts, so I'm, you know, I'm up 91 from you. But,
yes.
You know, our house is from 1900, and it's a mishmash of different eras and, you know, the foundation. And when you said the thing about like the engineer was surprised the place was even standing still. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. They said, as I wrote in the introduction, I kept saying, why do they always want to show you things? It's never good. I would be in my room writing, which was, it was a good way to write. People say, oh, how could you write during a renovation? But the renovation was so daunting and upsetting that in complete denial, I would just go into my room and type away and go to imaginary places, because then they would always stop me and say, can you come in here a minute? And I knew it was going to be, you know, something terrible. And I remember at one point, you know, my carpenter showing me that the kitchen was not even really attached to the living room.
What?
Yeah, it was kind of loose. He shook it for me dramatically to show me that it was not really quite connected. The kitchen was put on, I guess, at maybe a later point. But there was all sorts of horrifying things like that. That now anything, I guess I could conquer anything after that.
I feel like knocking wood or something because I don't want to tempt the fates. But it's so cool, though, because as you mentioned in the book, this is a house you knew as a child, just minutes from your mother's home. Is that right?
Yes, it was a family friend, and we used to, when we were kids, I kept my ponies here. I got ponies. We kept them in the barn, and we used to play tennis here. And when I first got my Saturday Night Fever album, I brought it over, and we danced in the rec room in the basement, and we played, do you know what sardines is?
I'm trying to remember. Is that what you try to like pretend you're a can of sardines?
No, it's sort of the opposite of hide and seek, in that everybody, one person hides, and then one at a time you find them, and then the last person who finds the whole crowd is the loser. But you try to find a person, you give a certain person a certain amount of time to hide, and then they go hide. And this house has all sort of nooks and crannies, so it was a good hiding place.
And then you would kind of jam in where they were, and everyone would jam together.
Yes. Okay. It was sort of a slash kissing game too.
Yeah, you know? I'm guessing.
You hope the person you liked, you know, you'd find them, and then nobody else would find you for a while. So
you grew up mostly in Connecticut and Massachusetts,
yes,
is that right?
Yes. So I grew up here, and also I had, you know, relatives in New York, spent a lot of time in New York. And but my family always lived in Connecticut, and so I would always come back to visit. And a number of years ago I bought a country house here. I was staying here for a little while, but I was working so much that I didn't keep it. But then when I was in Los Angeles during COVID, you know, just on complete lockdown with nothing to do, that's when I started the idea of working on the book, because it was something I'd always been sort of fascinated about. And I'd written about the swimmer extensively for a site I'm part of called Trailers from Hell. And I always wanted to do, because I was fascinated by the perception of Connecticut on screen and the way it was very contradictory, that you had all these kind of idyllic Christmas in Connecticut movies, but then you also had, you know, what I call dark suburbia, Man in the Gray Flannel Suit and Gentleman's Agreement. And so I wondered if I could, you know, have a through line to sort of explain the dichotomy. And that was my starting off point. But as I was writing the book at night, I found myself, like, you know, a bad corny Lifetime movie, scrolling through Zillow and kind of, you know, in complete lockdown in Los Angeles, thinking, geez, a nice farmhouse in Connecticut would be so much fun. And it was always my fantasy to, you know, fix up a farmhouse. And lo and behold, I just sort of let the universe kind of take over. And my neighbors across the street made me an offer on my house. And I was like, all right, I guess I'm moving to Connecticut. So it all happened. It was just kind of the universe telling me that, you know, this is what I needed to do. And so I wrote the second half of the book, which was completely unplanned. I didn't think I was going to be buying a fixer upper. It was not a plan at all, but
no one ever. Yeah. Right. No one ever plans for that.
No.
That happened to me.
No, not at all.
And I'm, it's so funny because, like, you're describing yourself, it is like the beginning of a movie, but it's, you know, these things, you know, people move, and this is not a Connecticut movie, but like Baby Boom, that must be a Vermont movie, right? The sort of like exile from a city into the country, kind of what you've done, or self-exile. And it either goes well because like Sam Shepard shows up and then woohoo, or it goes badly because you're like, you know, the Stephen King movie where someone breaks your leg and then you can't leave, like Misery. What is it for you now? Are you being stalked by crazy fans, or are things pretty pleasant for you?
No, it's really the first. I mean, there's a chapter I write, I call them country living comedies, which were very popular in the 1930s. And again, there's a germ of truth to all of these films, because people were working on Broadway and they were buying country houses in Connecticut, because it was, you know, near to the city. And so this was something that people were actually doing. And then these movies reflect, you know, a lifestyle that was, you know, that was really happening. And so all of these films, Bringing Up Baby, Theodora Goes Wild, there's a Cary Grant movie called In Name Only, they all have the same theme, which is a New Yorker, you know, moves, goes to the country or visits in the country, has a transformational experience, sure, sees there's a better way to live, country values, and ends up staying here. So that has been, you know, more what exactly what has happened to me, just because creatively, being in a city, it does weigh on you after a while. And so yeah. I just needed that change of scenery to be in Connecticut.
It's funny too, because like there's, you depend, like you're saying, depending on kind of when these movies are made or sort of the way you've clustered them together. I mean, sometimes it is the sort of like escape from the, you know, the rat race of the city, you know, get in touch with your true nature, slow down, fall in love, blah, blah, blah. But there's the other, like, I love the dark suburbia movies where it's like, wait a second, this place isn't paradise. It's a trap. And I, you know, some of the films here, I'm familiar with, but I want to highlight, I want someone to remake the movie, The Secret Life of an American Wife. Holy shit.
Did you watch it?
I've never seen it yet, but I'm looking at this and I'm like, this movie got made?
Yes. It's crazy.
Let's talk about that plot, because I think the listeners would really, at least I would enjoy hearing it. And I love the photo in here. And before we do that, I should probably, you know, describe the book, because this book is an object. It's gorgeous and it's substantial. It's oversized. So it's like 9 by 11, where most books are 6.5 by something. And it weighs 3.42 pounds. It's filled. I didn't weigh it. Trust me. It said that I checked, cause I was like, this is a heavy book, and it's filled with, you know, color and black and white photos. Some are movie still, some are your own, some are movie posters. I mean, this is like, as when people used to have coffee tables, you know, this is a coffee table book. But so on page 79 is a black and white still from The Secret Life of an American Wife. And there's I'm going to read the caption from the photo, and then you can tell us. A bored housewife, Victoria, played by Ann Jackson, has an extramarital affair with a movie star, Walter Matthau, to spice up her marriage in the secret life of an American Wife, the most risque of all Connecticut sex comedies, written and directed by George Axelrod. So I've kind of given away the plot. In the photo, they're like clinking glasses. It looks like there's a little bit of I don't know if that's whiskey or brandy. Okay, so tell us more about how this plot, because that there's even more that's more scandalous than even that descriptor.
Well, the movie opens with her. It shows all these housewives bringing their husbands to the train station, and then they go, you know, and then they go back home and they drink. And the first scene of Ann Jackson is her completely naked while the grocery boy comes in, and she's upset because he doesn't notice her body. And so that's when she decides, you know, she needs to feel sexy. And because she says, I've become one of those Connecticut housewives. And so it was so interesting to me because, again, there was this through line of, okay, how did we get from idyllic Connecticut, life in the like transformation, and then we're in suburbia, and that's Mr. Blandings. Everybody moved here, and then all the 60s movies were suddenly about, you know, housewives trapped in suburbia. And their husbands are commuting. Their husbands are never around. They're all neglected housewives. And everybody's drinking and having an affair. And that's why I devoted an entire chapter to these sex comedies, because all of the good ones all take place in Connecticut.
Well, there's more. Let's go back to this movie, though, because I just want to say her husband, she takes him to the train station. But remember what you said his job was in the city. I mean, wasn't he
he's a publicist. for Walter Matthau. And George Axelrod actually wrote the film for Frank Sinatra, who he worked with in The Manchurian Candidate, but he didn't end up playing it. Walter Matthau ended up playing it. But one of Walter Matthau's, and he doesn't even have a name, he's just called the movie star.
It's so good.
One of his proclivities is that at 1 o'clock every day, he has sex with a girl, you know, at a hotel.
A call girl.
And so Patrick O'Neill's job is to bring him women.
And this is the housewife's husband. That's his job, to bring women. Yeah. Yep.
And she wonders aloud to him. She says, I wonder if I could ever, you know, pass as a call girl. And of course he says, oh, that's ridiculous. So then she decides she's going to pretend she's a call girl and go and have an affair with him. And unlike these other films where they go right up to the edge and maybe they always use the excuse of like, well, I was pretty drunk last night. I don't quite know what happened. This one goes for it. And they do have an affair. And she comes home to her husband. He's none the wiser. And she's had this great experience. And Walter Matthau's had this great experience. And it's an incredibly interesting, forgotten film.
What makes it, it's insane. But so what do you think, since you've talked about this, the different views of suburbia, why do you think it is that in the 60s they started, I mean, there were these darker films from earlier, but what do you think it was about that time that it starts to be a little more twisted and less idyllic?
I mean, to me, the movies are reflective of sometimes of what actually happened. And I write about this, and I always use as an example Mr. Blanding Spills His Dream House and also Christmas in Connecticut. Christmas mm-hmm. in Connecticut was made in the 40s, post-war film, in which Barbara Stanwyck is a single gal, career gal, and in the end, she gets it all. She gets to keep her job at the magazine. She finds the right guy. She doesn't have to marry the guy she doesn't love. She ends up marrying, you know, she marries the soldier who's there on leave, and she gets to keep her job. Suddenly, as we get, and Mr. Blanding's Myrna Loy is totally involved in the renovation of the house. As we get into the 50s, and it starts with the man in the gray flannel suit, it's interesting that the housewife is this frustrated, angry, bitter woman who she's living in a shabby part of Connecticut. She wants to move to the suburbs. She wants, you know, she presses Gregory Peck into trying to get into upward mobility. And it's all about the unhappiness of upward mobility. Mm-hmm. So as we get into the end of the 50s and the 60s, what we now have is almost this completely underground culture of men and women drinking to excess,
right,
trapped in suburbia, especially the women. And I actually theorize that, you know, did films like Blanding's and Christmas in Connecticut set up this ideal situation where women thought they could have it all and they could live in the country and maintain, be a mom, but also have a career. And they found out it wasn't possible. And so they end up getting stuck in the suburbs. There's one movie that is like particularly chilling called Wives and Lovers, where Shelley Winters meets Janet Leigh, and she has a gay best friend, Shelley Winters does. And she introduces her to cocktails and drinking because she says, you're going to have a lot of time on your hands. And Janet Leigh leaves her job as a dentist. She's a dentist, but she leaves her job to support her husband, who's a writer. And again, the whole movie is about him being in the city and carrying on while she's stuck in the country. And Shelley Winters is advising her, you know, you better start decorating your house and giving cocktail parties and learning how to drink because your life is over.
So oh my God.
It's just very weird.
But it's so
message.
Interesting because I think, you know, when you, and you go back to, like you're saying, before the 50s, and the films that you mentioned, plus films, you know, all the Katharine Hepburn films, you know, or I think, you know, in here, you yeah. know, for example, Bringing Up Baby,
yeah,
and everything else that she represents, it just seems, was it a ploy, or were women more empowered in the 40s, and we just don't know it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think, you know, there was, I mean, part of it is, it's a bigger discussion. One of the things I learned, you know, people ask me, like, what are some surprising things you learned? Well, one of the biggest surprises is, of course, they took away a lot of the trains that used to travel pretty freely from New York City to Connecticut. So you could hop on the train and get to the city and have lunch in the city very easily. And once all the freeways came in, I think it was a little harder for women to get away. And that's where you see so many of these films with women suddenly in film after film, you know, relegated to just picking up their husbands at the train station, and they're stuck.
Right.
They're stuck. And the other sort of weird thing that you pick up in all these movies is, you know, was it an unconscious thing on the men to have the women away, tucked away in the suburbs? And oftentimes in these movies, you have the men having a little pied-à-terre in the city.
And that's, you know, and that makes a lot of sense, right? Because they could have separate lives, like the messiness. I mean, kids and the family, that could be compartmentalized, you know, in the country. And then you have your work and drinking and fooling around in the city. I mean, that makes a whole bunch of sense.
And it starts to get darker and darker and darker until until it finally crashes with, you know, the Stepford Wives, where it just is like, okay, let's break it all open. I want my wife to be a Playboy bunny. I don't want her to have any career at all, you know? And that is like the crescendo of that's what the book is about. How did we get from Katharine Hepburn to the Stepford Wives?
There's this other thing. It's interesting, you know, when I think about Connecticut and I think of sort of traditional Hollywood movies, there's no way to talk about it with this without talking about whiteness. And it's interesting that to think about, you know, kind of the drinking kind of waspy culture of Connecticut. I myself grew up in the Midwest. I'm Jewish, but I went to Yale for college. So I was there. And there is this sort of, you know, from Auntie Mame, the line about the Aryan from Darien. There is something, and to contrast that with not everyone in Hollywood, but there's a sort of, you know, old Hollywood Jewish filmmakers and directors. And I think maybe part of this sort of imagining the, you know, sort of waspy, all-American, you know, stereotypical American dream life and imagining it onto Connecticut in some ways.
Well, I try to break down that whole trope because it's to me, it's more about class.
There's
a class system here.
Yep.
And there's a puritanicalness to Connecticut, more so even than Massachusetts. You don't, you know, color outside the lines. You don't do things to draw attention to yourself. And so a lot of that goes back to, you know, just this Puritan, you know, lifestyle of, and that extends to, you know, having covenants to not accept Jewish people, Black people. It's almost beyond, you know,
covenants like in the in real estate transactions to not bring people to not just sell your house to somebody.
It's not so much even a black white thing. It's the right kind of people. You know, for instance, there are, you know, people, Paul Robeson lived in Connecticut and had a, you know, nice big mansion and was extreme, you know, was well-treated and people loved him. And so I think that if you possibly, if you had money or fame, then all of that went away, you know.
As long as you weren't too flashy, though, or flashy at all.
Exactly. But, you know, fame always was a big, you know, I think is always a big help in terms of some of these fitting in some of these, you know, neighborhoods. But I tried, there's a terrific film, a Whoopi Goldberg film called Good Fences, which is about a Black family trying to assimilate in the suburbs. By Ernest Dickerson, who was a director of photography for Spike Lee. And that is an extremely interesting film, very underseen film.
Good Fences, you said?
Good Fences, it's called. Very interesting. There's another movie, very underseen movie called Marshall, which is about Thurgood Marshall coming here and trying a case before he, you know, many, many years before he became a Supreme Court justice. It's directed by Reginald Hudlin, but it's fascinating. It's based on a real case with Thurgood Marshall came here and he worked with a lawyer named Sam Friedman. And it just was a very, very interesting case, a trial that happened in New Haven, where a woman accused her Black, I think it was her driver, of rape, and they went to trial, and he was acquitted by an all-white jury. And it's a fascinating case and a very, very interesting film with all sorts of implications.
Is it a documentary?
It's a film. It came out in 2017. Okay. Kind of overlooked. Wonderful performances from Josh Gad, and Sterling K. Brown plays the servant whose name was Joseph Spell. Kate Hudson plays the heiress. This all happened in Greenwich, Connecticut. It's just a fascinating. Fascinating entry in Connecticut.
Can we talk about your research and sort of gathering and writing process? I know that COVID makes it somewhat easier and the renovation or the destruction and construction helped you focus in some ways, but this seems like a lot of work to pull together. I mean, writing is always a lot, but like to make the choices for the films, to find the images you were going to use with them, and then maybe to even rewatch some of these. And I mean, it seems to some degree like you were low key researching this since you were a child, making mental notes, like you said, of like, oh, Connecticut's mentioned here. But how did you decide which films, and how many films did you rewatch?
Oh my goodness. There's 100 films in the book, but I probably watched more than that. And there were some movies, again, I just decided they just didn't fit, or I didn't think they were a very good film. And I just don't want to be negative. So it's like, if I don't think the movie is good, it makes it very hard to write about it. And it's not a book like Ultimate Guide to Connecticut. So I fall.
And that's fair. I mean, you don't want to do like a hate watch. I mean, it's a separate book.
No, there was a couple movies, you know, and again, I don't want to say what they are, but where I watched them and I was like, I wanted them to be good because they were based on maybe something that really happened in Connecticut, but it was, tough to watch.
So how do you watch? What is your ideal method of watching movies? Are you like popcorn, kick back on the sofa? Do you have like a giant screening room, or what do you do?
No, I just, I watch all my movies at night. So I would, you know, watch a film, take notes. I start to write about it. And again, there was a, I actually started with the swimmer and then kind of worked myself back from the swimmer. And I just thought, well, you know, let me watch the movies and then I would take notes. And then it started putting them together in some form. And
can you go back to that? Like, why did you, I mean, the swimmer, it's a gorgeous photo. It's such an interesting photo on the cover. But why did you choose the swimmer? What does that film mean to you, in addition to what you wrote about it for the book?
The swimmer, for so many reasons, it's just a very evocative image. And for me, Connecticut is a dichotomy where there's this tremendous beauty, but there's also a kind of a somewhat a sinister and a dark quality. Like what happens behind those, you know, the ivy, you know, the ivy fences, there's great wealth, there's poverty, there's old money, there's a lot of blue collar money, and there's the bourgeoisie, which is what the swimmer is about. And mm-hmm. It goes back to my, you know, when I first worked in New York for this publicist, Peggy Siegel, and we shared an office with Frank Perry, the director of The Swimmer, and mm-hmm. he gave me all, you know, movies of his to watch, which were then on VHS. And I saw The Swimmer, and I just had never really realized, I never saw a movie about Connecticut. And it captured, for me, a lot of things I saw in my youth, parents, you know, the partying and the, it rang very true for me. And that feeling in the film that he doesn't fit in and he's done, there's something unconscious that he's done that he doesn't know about, but he's been thrown out of the club.
And that's based on, so The Swimmer was made, it looks like in 1968, based on a John Cheever short story.
Yes.
And it stars Burt Lancaster, I guess.
Yes.
But it looks like when I was reading, you were writing about how like it went through several different directors or something.
Burt Lancaster was very hands-on in all of the films that he was, you know, that he starred in, and he was unhappy with the director Frank Perry, and so he fired him. He also fired Barbara Loden, who played his lover. And she was replaced with Janice Rule. And then Barbara Loden was married to Ilya Kazan. There's lot of these Connecticut connections here. After she was fired, she made a movie, Wanda, you know, with the help of Ilya Kazan, again, in and around Connecticut. But Burt Lancaster then fired Frank Perry. And he brought in Sidney Pollack to direct a couple of the scenes.
That's incredible. Like a very young Sidney Pollack, right?
Yes. And those, and that scene was shot in California. And it's almost like a set piece on its own, which I write about. Doesn't quite fit within the movie, but since the whole movie has this weird dreamlike quality, you know, it works in its own sort of shattered viewpoint. But there's so many touchstones in the movie for me that, you know, that remind me of Connecticut. And then I love Burt Lancaster because his performance is a deconstruction of Burt Lancaster. And that's why I thought it needed to be on the cover. But on the back cover, I have a picture of my grandfather and Mr. Blandings builds his dream house. So
I want to talk about that. I'm glad that I was going to pivot to your own life. I mean, you're connected obviously to Connecticut and to the movies.
Yes.
It's kind of in your blood. When did you see, so Mr. Blandings builds his dream house, which has all the product placement, which is hysterical in it.
Yeah.
It stars your grandfather. Do you want to talk about your relationship with him, Melvin Douglas, and how that brought you into your career as an actor and producer and director?
Well, again, you know, growing up here, you know, we had a very artsy family, and I spent a lot of time with my grandfather. He was always encouraging me to write, and I would, you know, write him things, and the whole family just sort of you know, had that kind of art. I used to say it like when we used to visit up in the summer, it was like being in a Chekhov play. You know, there was always interesting people around and artists and writers, and you'd go swim in the lake and at night you'd see movies and there'd be great, you know, dinners and cocktail conversation. And so it always, in my mind, I wanted to be in that world. You know, I wanted to be in that artistic world, not a business world. So I was always leaning in that direction anyway. Right. But as I got to be closer with my grandfather and then, you know, visited him on a movie set, you know, I just thought, oh, this is definitely what I want.
I mean, it must have been magic, right? Did you feel that on the set?
Oh, yeah. I was very privileged to visit him on some of these film sets and meet some of the people. I met Myrna Loy on a number of occasions.
And, wow.
You know, Patricia Neal. There's so many great people. Fred Astaire. Just, you know, it just was magical. And mm-hmm. So then as I began my career in movies, it was funny, I sort of forgot about my grandfather for a while. But then as I started writing my own memoir, I Blame Dennis Hopper, that's when I kind of realized in working at Turner Classic Movies, oh, this has come full circle. I was always writing about movies and watching movies and talking about movies, but not in such an intellectual way. I just loved movies and knew a lot of trivia, and I knew I'd met a lot of these people. But then that's when I began to think, oh, I've had this whole kind of inside, outside sort of career where I've met some of these people. I mean, the writers of Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House were up in Vermont when I was a kid. So I met them.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, before I even knew about Mr. Blandings, I knew them. I mean, I remember meeting writers and thinking, you know, my grandfather telling me that they wrote for Bob Hope. So I thought that was really exciting because they wrote for Bob Hope. But then as I began to get older and do my own acting, that's when I realized what a great actor my grandfather was and how many parallels to my own career that I've had with him. You know, he always had a hand in writing and producing mm-hmm. and he was, you know, involved in politics, so.
Are you that kind of person on the set? Like, are you, you know, I'm thinking, I mean, you know, your work is so incredible. I mean, every role you bring, you're so interesting to watch. Like, you're just one of these faces and actors who I just like, I love seeing. And I'm thinking one film I think of comes to mind is To Die For with Nicole Kidman. And I think, do you play like her sister-in-law or something?
Yes, I play her sister-in-law, yeah.
And there's like a scene by the pool that I still remember where it's like the point where like we as an audience should realize like there's some serious red flags with this, with her character. And
right.
You're like the voice of all of us kind of in this way in that scene. But I just wonder whether if you, you know, what your... you were just talking about Burt Lancaster, like firing people and stuff. I think of that film, was that one directed by Martin Scorsese?
No, that was directed by Gus Van Sant.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
It had a quality of sort of a documentary.
Yes.
Kind of quality to it. And that was, you know, when I met Mike Nichols for the first time. He was the inspiration for me writing my memoir.
Mike Nichols was? The guy who directed The Graduate?
Yes.
Wow.
The master, the maestro.
Yeah.
As I was standing in line with the director, Glenn Gordon Caron, who I'd worked with on Picture Perfect, and we went to see Mike Nichols talk, and I brought an album, a Nichols and May album, for him to sign. And you know, Glenn was like, only you could get away with that. Like, what? Get him to sign it. So I was there as a fan of Mike Nichols, you know, not mm-hmm. thinking, oh, Mike Nichols is going to even talk to me. I put my album out for him to sign. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he recognized me and he said, oh, you know what I like about you? You're in the movie, but you're also outside the movie in the audience. It was just like what you said.
Oh, my goodness. Right. Yes. Oh, good. Good. Good.
He said, it's like somehow you got from the audience and you're in the movie and you're somehow you're in the movie. Like, you're us. You're talking to us. And I said, wow, that explains my whole life. And then that's when I thought that's going to be the through line to my book. And I always tell writers, you know, anybody has five or six great stories, but the key to writing a book, because people always said to me, oh, you have to write a book. You're so funny. You have all these great stories, but there's no through line.
Right,
and so Mike Nichols gave me the through line when he said, what I like about you is you're in the movie, but it's like you're outside the movie.
Now I have to read that. That was your first book, right?
Yes.
And remind me of, it's called I Blame Dennis Hopper and Other Stories from a Life Lived in and Out of the Movies. Okay.
Yes. So that was the through line for all of the stories, which are, they're stories about how one movie or one individual, whether it's Marlon Brando or Richard Dreyfuss, Liza Minnelli, how one person, an actor, whether I knew them or didn't know them, changed the trajectory of my life. And in that moment, Mike Nichols changed the trajectory of my life as a writer, because now I had a through line and I realized that is, so when I write, and with this book too, it's as if I'm in the car, you know, I call it a cinematic road trip through Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's, you're going to read the book and it's as if I'm next to you in the car and pointing out these places and we're going to take a nice stop and you're going to learn about the movie, but you're going to also learn about where it was shot and the, you know, the kind of the essence of the film. In many instances, a lot of these films were based on real people or real events or real locations that somebody could visit.
That is so cool. And I, in fact, right now, while we've been talking, I've been driving south on 91. Look out the front window. That's me in the car, Ileana, right there. Let's hop in. We're going to go drive around.
Let's
is that
go.
Okay?
Go to Miami. Get some pizza.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I'm afraid to ask, but New Haven Pizza, which is it?
Oh.
Is it Modern Sally's or Pepe's?
Oh God, it's too hard. They're all good for me.
Okay, but the answer is Pepe's, right?
Well, Pepe's is pretty good.
I know I'm supposed to say Modern or Pizza, but you know, I'll take Pepe's anytime. But when you grew, back to life in Connecticut, you used to hang out. Is there still a drive-in movie theater there? I mean, are you going back to your old haunts?
No, there's no more drive-ins, and they were so much a part of my childhood, going to the drive-in. It was so funny because it only cost $1 to go in, and it was dusk till dawn movies. But I remember we would all get packed in the trunk. You know, there's like a bunch of kids, and we'd sneak in the trunk, and then, you know, watch horror movies till dawn. So there was a lot of movies that I saw that I probably wasn't supposed to see.
Did you have like a station wood, a faux wood paneled station wagon or no?
I did not. I used to go with a friend and they had some kind of, you know, back when cars were huge and it was like some sort of giant Pontiac with an enormous trunk, you know, just beyond belief. But other than that, I mean, you'd go on dates to the drive-in. It was like the drive-in was everything when I was a kid. But there were other movie theaters too. There was a place I used to go to called Cine Studio in Hartford, where I'd see a lot of art films. I'd go all over the place. Essex had a movie theater. Old Saybrook had a movie theater. Oh, Madison. The only one that still exists is the one in Madison.
So I'm going to go back. It's one thing in the book. I just want to circle back to that before we leave. there's a chapter. I mean, the chapter titles are just incredible. I love you start with silent films of Connecticut, country living comedies, and we get into, you know, crimes and misdemeanors. And then I love the dark suburbia redux, because this is sort of like revisiting those themes.
Yes.
And one of them is The Ice Storm, directed by Ang Lee, which is just utterly brilliant. It takes you on such a journey. I haven't seen it since I saw it, I think, the first time. For me, I think of all the movies that hit me, of the ones that the 100 that you cover over essentially 100 years, I think of all of them, that is the film that like stabbed me in the heart. Are there other movies that of these in this book that you think I can't miss, that I should definitely watch, other than the ones we've talked about, that would really take me on that same kind of emotional journey?
Well, what I tried to do with Dark Suburbia Redux, which I discovered that there are so many, you know, there are a category of modern films, but that they depict Connecticut and they redefine Connecticut culture and the suburban malaise, I call it, of the past.
Sure.
But what's interesting about these films, they're all shot in a very artsy, slow moving, they're almost like surreal, you know?
And
that's what I liked about them. So these include, you know, The Ice Storm, Revolutionary Road, The Land of Steady Habits, Far From Heaven.
Oh, I did see Far From Heaven. Boy, that was intense too. Yeah. Well, Julianne Moore, right?
Yes. And so what the filmmakers do is that what fascinates about me is it's not that they're exactly accurate. They are stylized versions of the past in which they take a modern approach and comment on the past, which I think is fascinating. Most of them are more dark than the actual films made in the 50s, you know, like The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. But what they're striving for is to give a voice to people that did not, in the 60s, we always saw was like swinging 60s. But in The Ice Storm, we now give a voice to the angst and the melancholy in these. And I, you know, in The Ice Storm is just a masterpiece. It's a very sad, I mean, it's a beautiful film, but it's an extremely sad film. And it's one of Ang Lee's sort of more early films, but
he also direct Brokeback Mountain? Do I have that right?
Yes, he went on, of course, to do, you know, Brokeback Mountain and, you know, a bunch of other successful films. But this is going back to, you know, 1997. So that was a
right, and it was set in the 70s, and maybe that's why my childhood was the 70s. So when you know to be able to look through today's lens, or I guess the 90s is a long time ago. I think of it as just yesterday.
Yeah.
So how are you spending, now that you're almost done, the book is done, you're so far from Hollywood, how are you spending your time, and is there another creative project that you're thinking of working on?
Well, I've already started. I had an idea for what my next book is going to be, which again is going to be a movie book. Can't really talk about it, unfortunately.
Of course.
But I already have that idea. So thank God. It's better to at least know what you're going to work on. So I'm going to be working on that. It's going to take a tremendous amount of research. You know, what's always hard in research is, again, you start to go, with this book in particular, it got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Sure.
And I started to go down a rabbit hole of, I want to include this, and okay, the American Indians, and they invented tobacco farming. And then so this is like a movie parish. It was so dense in terms of, it's about the tobacco industry. It's about jet setters in the early 60s. It's about the bourgeoisie. It's about the field workers that, you know, slaved in the tobacco fields. It's about Martin Luther King coming to work as a teenager in Simsbury. Like, it's so dense, right, that those are the hardest things. So the next project that I'm going to work on is just going to be one thing that I just researched the hell out of that one thing.
But that I always makes sense. Going deep instead of broad. But that, you know, you do different. I think every project is hard and everyone is different, but it's so nice to be able to have that, you know, in front of you.
Yes. I always wanted to do, since I was a kid, a coffee table book with pictures that was, you know, about movies. And so I'm really proud of the amount of work that we put in and setting up the photos. There's like 300 photos in it. And so
it's incredible.
Thank you. Yeah. There's at least, you know, 10 things that people will say, wow, I never thought of that. And also, I also like to write books because I was this way as a kid. You don't have to start at the beginning. I mean, you can start at the beginning if you want to get the whole, you probably, like, if you want to skip to a chapter and then go back and read the whole thing, that's fun too.
I love that too, because now, you know, so, you know, a lot of people don't buy physical books anymore because they're like, I can listen to the Audible or whatever, or I'll look at it on my, and you know, I like books as objects, and I love, like, this is a book that, you know, it's my kids can pick up. You know, anyone who comes by, a family member or a friend can look at it. And, you know, it's the attention, just the cover photo alone tells a story, you know, every detail in it, with Burt Lancaster holding whoever, we can't see her body. We just see her face, her legs, her feet, the shoes she's wearing. You see a fence, you see a pool, and you're like, what is going on in this, you know, you want to know more. And I think I love that about the book. And so, before we leave, is there anything I forgot to ask you, and, or how do people find you on your book tour?
Well, people can go to, they can go to my Facebook page, Connecticut in the Movies, or Instagram, and, you know, I'm posting a lot of my events there. The biggest one I have coming up is I'm going to be at the Kate November 15th in Old Saybrook with Colin McEnroe from NPR. And we're going to be doing a show called Lights, Camera, Connecticut.
Oh, how fun.
And then I'll be at the Mark Twain House November 30th. And I'm going to be in Los Angeles. But if you go to my Facebook page or my Twitter, Instagram, which is at Ileana Rama, you can sort of track me down there. But I'm just really hopeful that people, you know, buy the book and enjoy it and give it as a Christmas present. That would be the best. You know.
Oh, it's a great idea. I mean, how many people, what is the population of Connecticut? Do you know?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean,
I don't either. I'm guessing it's got to be at least a million, no? At least 600,000 to a million people. What do I know? I'm laughing.
I know.
I'm going to Google it while we're talking so someone doesn't like write into me that I'm an idiot. Population of Connecticut.
Yeah, that would be.
Oh, okay. I wasn't so far off. It's 3.6 million. Well, so I'm thinking, you know, that's at least a million books right there.
Yeah.
People in Connecticut, right? Come on. You live in Connecticut. You need to buy this book. Right,
definitely. You have to. And hopefully, again, my last, you know, most, I end the book with the one film that I did here, which is called The Green, a movie I'm very proud of. It was actually the first gay film made in Connecticut, and involves the storyline of a teacher being falsely accused of a crime. And we shot the whole thing in Guilford. Mm-hmm. It just was an incredible experience. And I would very much like to, you know, bring films back here and have people filming here again. And I hope that the book is a blueprint for people to be reinvested in the state as a great place to film and then hire me.
You know, and who is the, the governor, I don't know who's the governor of Connecticut. I mean, you need to get to the laws changed to get some some special tax treatment for the film industry. That would be good, right?
Well, I've been trying to get the, you know, I've been trying to get a meeting with the governor about this. So hopefully once he reads the book, he'll, you know, he'll see what a great place it is to make movies.
That's a great idea. Well, thank you so much for spending this time with me, Ileana.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you reaching out.
I could have continued that conversation for so much longer, and I don't want to be a stalker, but I would love to drive down. It's only like maybe an hour and a half from where I live. I would love to drive down to her house and like ask her to give me a tour of the progress of the renovation, but I know that's super creepy. But you know, you never know. I mean, maybe she'd be totally, totally fine with it. I really, as I said, when I was talking to Ileana, that this book is an object, and there was a time when, and I think there still is, when people enjoy coffee table books, but this would be, if you live in Connecticut, or if you just love the movies, this is a gorgeous book, gorgeous holiday present. I know it's only October, but it's not too soon to start your holiday shopping. I really love this, and I really do hope more movies can be made in the, what do they call Connecticut? Do they call it like the Nutmeg State? I don't know. But this is, it's gorgeous. It's fun. It is also a great, I think it's a great resource for films that you haven't seen that you want to see, or films that you want to see again. One thing I forgot to ask Ileana about her father, Melvin Douglas, is about one of his roles, his more recent roles, when he, toward the end of his career, her grandfather was in that amazing Peter Sellers movie, Being There. And I'm going to rewatch that film. You know, that's the film where Peter Sellers plays Chauncey Gardner. And I think Melvin Douglas has maybe a small cameo role, or not a cameo, but a small role, as someone who kind of changes this man's life, the Peter Sellers character, and sets all the action in that film in motion. So that is on my list. I'm also going to watch several of these films that I have learned about. And if you come visit me, if you come by and see me at any time in the next, I don't know how many years, Connecticut in the Movies is going to be on my coffee table. And thanks for joining us. I will be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Please let us know what you think. Send me an email at bookedup@politicon.com. And you can also write to us at Booked Up, P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give us a 5-star review. It really will help other people find us.